No. Be afraid. Be very afraid.
There's nothing to fear except God. Whatever that means to you.
Do I look like someone who cares what God thinks?
You're listening to a podcast exploring faith and fear, what scares us and what saves us. This is The Fear of God.
Hello, and welcome back to The Fear of God. A whole new year, a whole renewed podcast. Find all of your favorite foggy paraphernalia at thefearofgodpodcast.com. Every week here in the fog, we explore what scares us in order to find what saves us. Typically, your hosts are a Mr. Nathan Rouse and a Mr. Reed Lackey. Today, I am the fogophile who has been treating you to the In the vocabularistic stylings of one Mr. Edgar Allan Poe across 7 or 8 weeks of patron segments. Oh, what is that? You're not a patron currently. Well, you have indeed been missing out. You should join the Fear of God's patron, right? Patreon, that is. An elder gentleman trying to understand new fandango technology is always a recipe for disaster, if you know what I mean. Go join the Fear of God's Patreon, and you can listen to all the individual little segmented mini conversations the boys have done, along with other friends and whatnots, about Mike Flanagan's The Fall of the House of Usher television series on Netflix. What's that? It's not really television anymore. I don't know anymore. But today, the boys will be right along to wrap up what has been quite the conversation discussing this most just splendid television show. Dark, heavy, but perhaps splendid as well. Now, it is time for the podcast. Reed! Hey, buddy!
Hey, Nathan! Hey. How's it going, man?
I'm good. Hey. That was weird. It was sort of like the sound of jingling bells.
Ooh.
You know, it's kind of how I experienced
all of
whatever
that
just happened there.
Wow. Have you seen a doctor?
Yeah, I don't know how you...
Listen.
Not lately. In fact, the doctor I do go to lately, I told my wife, I was like, I don't think I'm going to go to that guy anymore.
Oh, see?
He just doesn't really...
Time to get real.
Very helpful.
Yeah. I understand. Yep.
You asked.
I did. I meant it.
Reed, we got just an absolutely just erudite introduction by
we
our
sure
fogophile.
Did. Oh, handsome
join
guy.
Join Patreon
that guy.
To meet him. I like to think so. little William Wilson action going on there.
Ooh.
Bada boom, bada bing. If you haven't met the fogophile, you know, go join Patreon.
Join Patreon.
Or wait, I don't know, a few months now and listen to the complete conversation. We are today wrapping up our conversation on Netflix's The Fall of the House of Usher. If you want more didactics on individual episodes, this is not the conversation for you. We will be discussing some broader elements, some ranking a few things, but our primary point of conversation today will be just some of the things this show has put in our mind and our hearts and our spirits.
Indeed.
And here we are. So, about this TV show.
Yeah, this series. Yes. Indeed.
This series.
So one of the things I'd like to start with, actually, per your suggestion, along the way on the different patron segments, we decided that we were going to read the short stories that broadly inspired this Netflix series, conceived, showrun, and directed, many episodes directed by Mike Flanagan. And so we were reading a lot of Edgar Allan Poe. Man, can I tell you before we dive into these? So I have loved Edgar Allan Poe since I was a real little kid. And after our conversation with JR and Matt, I went and looked up. They are literally called Great Illustrated Classics, and you can buy some of them. And I think I'm going to buy a couple of those little books that I read as kids. You know, the ones that I referenced that are just like they're illustrated and they're just kind of kid versions of these stories.
Classic.
I'm like, oh, man, it's great. Yes. But I've loved Edgar Allan Poe since I was a kid. But even the first time I watched this series, it merely made me go like, oh, man, I love Edgar Allan Poe. I'm glad that this happened. But reading these stories and then marrying them up with the episodes that we've watched has really just elevated my appreciation for Poe, broadly speaking. I'm just like, man, I said on the patron segment, again, if you want to hear all our patron conversations, go join Patreon. But I said on our one of our most recent patron episodes, I think for horror fans, Edgar Allan Poe is our Shakespeare. He inspired so much, influenced so much. His stories and his work, even in his very, very short life, just really, you can see so many things that developed into other things later on, and they create this wonderful tapestry, this great template that somebody with a creative mind like Flanagan can come across and just can do some wonderful things with. So that having been said, we read 10, was it 10 short stories? 9. We read 9 Poe short stories. I read 10, you read 9. Poe short stories. One of them was extra credit by design, so it was fine.
It's just funny. It's just like never miss an opportunity for one-upmanship. But, I mean, you win, Reed. You know, you win.
Yes, I do. So basically, the we are going to name of the core stories we read. What are our top 3 favorites? Do you want to volley back and forth 3-1 on this?
Yes, we can do that.
Okay.
Of the ones we read, my number 3 is The Pit and the Pendulum.
Ooh.
Largely not because of its thrilling design, but because I was so unready for the swerve it takes at the end.
Oh yeah.
Based on the fact that I'd seen the episode back when I watched the show initially, and so I'm naturally just expecting, you know, a severing.
He gonna get got.
Gonna get got, and he don't. He get got.
He get got. He get saved.
He got.
He
got
up.
Get. So I don't know. I was just it in a way that much of these texts didn't. Not because they're all dour. I don't mean that, but just like I had a real like, oh, well, what do you know? Very triumphal sort of experience.
Sure,
when it gets to those last few sentences. It was a very delightful experience getting to that. So yeah, Pit and the Pendulum is number 3 for me.
It was very, very tough. Spoiler alert, it is not. It was very, very tough to cut Pit and the Pendulum from my list. It didn't land in my top 3, but I love that story. For, you know, that reason and so many others, I think it's a really, really wonderful story. So yeah, I'm happy that you included it. My number 3 is The Mask of the Red Death. Hmm. For me, the tightness of that story, but also, man, I still find the ending of that story so wonderfully chilling. Just everybody living it up. The plague is out there. It can't get in here. And then the spectral figure just coming in can't be stopped, can't be shut out, can't be avoided. And it has just a powerfully apocalyptic kind of ending. And it's one of the briefest short stories that we read. So yeah, I absolutely love The Mask of the Red Death. So I landed it at number 3.
Okay. Well, what's your number 2? What kind of snake?
Oh, snake back 3. Okay. So my number 2, probably relative to my affection from childhood and you know, ramping up into it, it's the story that by memory first introduced me to one Mr. Edgar Allan Poe. My number 2 is The Telltale Heart, because it remains one of, I think, the most perfect short stories ever conceived by any literary mind. I think it's very spooky, it's powerful, it's simple, it's direct, and it's remarkably effective. And like I said, it was the first Poe short story that I read, and to this day, still one of my favorites. So number 2, The Telltale Heart.
I dig it.
What say you?
Here's the thing, Reed, and something I've learned about you is, generally speaking, you are not, but I'm a fan of surprise. I'm a fan of a surprise.
Yes.
That was a funny bit directed you right.
It is.
And so I was so... surprising myself because of how it surprised me, Rue Morgue is my number two on this list.
Ah, nice.
And mainly because in this go-round, reading that story, not only is, as we referenced when we talked about it more directly, the sort of, you know, world's greatest detective type of energy around it, you know, with sure. that Batman cracking the case here. But because as I'm reading that text and I'm thinking about the episode, which I'd seen previously, I read this one first, this go round, and I'm trying to find the connecting points. And I was now forgive my, okay, listeners, science brains, nerds, forgive my simian ignorance here. That's not the point. But when you get to a certain point, you're like, oh snap, did a monkey do it? You know, you're like, wait a minute.
Like, oh man,
that's the connecting point. And then it's literally like that thought hits me. And then the detective, he's like, a monkey did it. It's like, oh yeah.
Yeah. You got I called it.
What a wonderful day.
You start beating your chest like, oh. Oh my god, that's awesome.
No, it was just a fun little turn. I was like, okay,
that's
our connecting point at the TV show. Didn't see that coming. So yeah, the monkey's his uncle is why I liked
Oh my two. God, I love it. All right, man, snaking around. I gotta hear you number one. What you got?
You do. So I referenced this on our patron segment last week, or at least I alluded to it. I said, ooh, don't look at the man behind the curtain.
Pay no attention.
Number one on my list is The Fall of the House of Usher.
Mm.
But there is a very particular reason why. Well, the in-text reason, okay? The in-text reason is I have, and to you, Reed, who've been present for all of these, if you're not a patron, you're going to catch them soon. If you are a patron, you've been present for some of these, except if you looked at the runtime of the overall episode, and you're like, oh my God, and then you realize that it's just the patron segment. It's like 45 minutes long.
Right.
I've continually referenced how one of my absolute favorite elements of the show is the tête-à-tête between Dupin and Roderick Usher, yes, the Elder, in this gothically staged haunted house, effectively the titular House of Usher. And so I just, several of these I'd never read. You know, if you'd said, hey, describe to me the plot of the short story, The Fall of the House of Usher, I probably would have said, like, a dude's kind of world falls down around him. But that's really the sum of my sort of expectations. So the thrill of just discovering, oh,
yeah,
here's the source of that dynamic.
That's right.
Right. Is right here. So that's the in-text love and why it ranks number one. But the real reason that pushes it up top of the list here, and I reference him a number of times over the course of The Fear of God, but I'm going to shout out a local friend and good buddy of quite a long time here, Stephen Scaregrove. So his last name is actually Hairgrove, but his fog name is Scaregrove. So myself, Stephen, and Gory Gamer Matt Murray, a couple times a year, we'll just gather at a secluded, you know, typically kind of mountain house and literally read. My wife, like, I'm always a little hesitant to even divulge just how absurd and obscene it kind of is. Like, we literally just sit, we arrive, we share, you know, friendly, gentlemanly hugs and pats. Yeah. And we have like a 30-minute combo catching up. And then we literally sit down and start playing a board game of some kind and more or less get up, you know, three and a half days later and get in the car and go home. It's more or less that. Well,
so awesome.
I'm getting around to Follow the House of Usher. Well, this particular trip, which is different than how these usually go. Usually there's some other nerdy stuff baked in here in terms of the board games. Literally, we basically played Arkham Horror, two different campaigns, the entire time.
Oh, okay.
So we did Path to Carcosa one. We did something like The Elder Gods was the second one. And I am the reader of the narrative as we are playing these games. So I'll, you know, get to use voices and talk like this and do other things that are very high and falutin and whatnot.
Sure.
And so I'm the reader the whole time. By the end of the thing, I'm a little spent because if you've ever looked at one of these Fantasy Flight Games, LCG, Arkham Horror campaigns, they are verbose. There's a lot of prolixity going on in these books here.
Yes.
And so by the end of it, I'm just kind of worn out. But it's a great time.
Yeah.
But there's this whole gothic energy to the entire weekend, this particular one. So you're dwelling in Arkham. You're making these choices that all end in some version of failure. Matt turned into an alien. True story. And so then on the way home, I was driving. And Steven lives in Charlotte, where I do. Matt lives elsewhere. And so Steven and I are driving home. And I, in addition to all the Arkham reading, am now reading Harry Potter aloud to our seven-year-old. So I've been doing a lot of read aloud.
Mm-hmm.
This is a long-winded way of saying the concept of the read aloud is heavy on my brain, heart, and what has been feeding me a lot lately. And I was like, Steven, you're a guy. He's got three sons, and he loves to read stories aloud to his kids. And I was like, you know what, Steven? I've got to do some homework for The Fear of God, namely read The Fall of the House of Usher.
Wow.
Would you read it to me?
Oh, my gosh. That is
so
awesome.
On this car ride home, I was just listening to a good friend just read The Fall of the House of Usher out loud to me, and I would hand him my phone to write down funky words as we found them.
Wow.
Like, hey, write that one down. What was that you just said? And it was so funny. There was a moment where we were trying to suss out a thing that just happened because it's Poe text, and it's a little knotted in places.
Yeah,
and
certainly.
Steven's basic summary of what he had just read was a lot of words about dread. I'm like, yes. Yes. Thus is Edgar Allan Poe. You get it.
It's a wonderful Poe summary. So,
yes. That is a long-winded way of saying why House of Usher in text and metatextually became, okay, this was a lot of fun having it read aloud to you.
That's wonderful.
It being the discovery of the sort of Dupin Usher template. So,
yes.
So that is the top of my list for these short stories.
Let me, first of all, that was delightful. Absolutely delightful. I loved hearing that.
You were missed. You were missed.
I know. Friends. I'm like, oh, man, my heart went out that I'm like, oh, geography is such a painful thing. But I will say what's great about The Fall of the House of Usher, I shared this on the patron segment as well. Most, if not all, literary critics tend to point to The Fall of the House of Usher as the Edgar Allan Poe short story. But also what's great about it is the show is called The Fall of the House of Usher. And when you discover, as you did, that it is the entire Dupin-Usher dynamic, and then you realize, oh, so it's appropriate that it is the framing device for the entire show, that literally we start there and we end there, and that, yes, you have been seeing the vast adaptation of the story, The Fall of the House of Usher, while, and I mean, it's just one more notch in the brilliance of the adaptation that I find really compelling and wonderful. And so, yeah, that delights me so, so much. What's great about this, we read 9 Poe short stories. I was worried we would have some crossover. We do not. And so I'm really, really happy in this little way that I'm like, oh, we've highlighted 6 of them when I cite mine that are like, oh, they're favorites. And so it just, again, speaks to how wonderful so many of these stories are. My favorite, my number one, which I struggled with because Telltale Heart has a lot of emotional significance to me. But when I was getting right down to it, I was like, what's the one that I could pull up with the snap of my fingers, read it, I would laugh, I would get the spooks, I would enjoy my time, and what is the most perhaps like cinematic of the literary piece, as in like a movie in my mind? So I had to go with The Cask of Amontillado. Number one, my favorite is The Cask of Amontillado, because it really does, as we've cited last week in the patron segment, it is the most dialogue heavy of any story that we read, maybe the most dialogue heavy of any of his stories. And if you have actors in your mind portraying the Fortunato and Montresor characters, you could really see it all play out. And there's a tremendous amount of humor in it, some of which I cited last week, but I really, really love that story. I'll dive one more bit in, just spending a little bit more, another moment, because it's my favorite. I also love the darkness underneath it, where it's like, it's a really dreadful thing that has happened in this story. I mean, a man believes he has been wronged. We actually don't know definitively if he has truly been wronged. He just believes he has been. And so because he believes he's been wronged, he transacts this retribution against Fortunato that is ultimate and dreadful and deadly. And it's just really dark and kind of touches on these corners of the human spirit that are very, very real in all of us in terms of our desire to want to like transact a thing. But by doing it this way, he really just drives home the uncanny horror of it. Like that grisly last line where he says, "For the love of God, Montresor," Fortunato says in the like, "For the love of God, Montresor," and he screams it. And then you can imagine Montresor saying back to him, "Yes, for the love of God," and then puts like the final brick in there. It's just got such a power to it. So for me, yeah, the favorite is The Cask of Amontillado. I love it so much. And again, I love so much that we highlighted six different stories. That just makes me very happy. So
yeah. Yeah. And it, I mean, that was a lot of fun. Like I knew when you and I had endeavored to go through the show, before you even proposed it, I was like, we should do some texts alongside it.
Sure.
You know, I sometimes can begrudge our homework, but I knew it was a worthwhile exercise, to coincide with the viewing of the show and, you know, nice to kind of put the literary component to bed for, I'm sorry.
What?
Huh? Foggle file. Well, sure. Just come on. Oh, hello. I'm back. And, you know, I just did not. Hello. I am assuming you are Mr. Lackey.
Yes.
You know, I did not want to.
You just threw Nathan right off the balcony. You just.
I did. You know, he chased a cat right over and just, you know, went all akimbo and head over heels right off of the.
Wow.
Right off. It's a, don't worry. It's the first floor. He's okay.
Okay. All right. Good.
But I did not want your little program to get far away from the text of Mr. Edgar Allan Poe, specifically Poe's prose, without perhaps just one last run at some of these words we might have left behind as we went on our merry way through these texts. So just three.
Okay.
Sir,
okay.
If you
I'm here
if
for
you'll
them.
Permit me, I'm going to. Yes. There are three. Initially, I wrote down what they were from. That eludes me now. So just trust that these are part of the texts that you have been discussing.
Okay.
Okay. Here they are. Are you ready? Gather around. This is if you've not been part of the patron party, you've missed out on Poe's prose, which is just
right.
a part of the segment where we discuss. Yes. We discussed the vocabularistic stylings of one Mr. Edgar Allan Poe, and what a mister he is. So come close. Come close around the fire. You too, young man. You too, come along. And the first word, I'm going to stick around for the whole of the recitation.
Wonderful.
The large hairy gentleman, he found his way into the Rue Morgue. Get it? That's a large gorilla joke.
Gorilla joke.
The first word that got left by the wayside that we're going to include here, we're going to fold it in like the cheese, is viand.
Ooh. Viand. Okay.
It's, forgive me, young man. You know, when you get to be my age, you have to put on your half moon spectacles to be able to see what the hell is on this stupid device we all carry around. A viand. An item of food.
Ooh.
Isn't that funny? A viand.
I have... I'm going to call it that.
Things we
all
come up
the time.
With, yeah.
Well, I think the viand I am ordering today is the cheeseburger. And so, yes.
It's like when you're throwing a party. Did you supply a sufficient spread of viands?
Yes. You know? Oh, yes.
People will... When your party guests show up, you can say, you can hang your coat there. And the viands are over there.
You can partake
sure
of the viands
totally
in the foyer.
Absolutely understand what you are referring to.
That's awesome.
Let's see what is next. Oh, okay. Bestir. B-E-S-T-I-R. Ooh. Bestir. That is a good word. A good
wonderful
word.
Wonderful word.
To make a physical or mental effort to exert or rouse oneself. I am bestirred to be here with you.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, and I am just enkindled for you to be here.
Well, I like that word, too. The last one. The last word on the list of Poe's prose is the word. Give me a moment.
Oh.
It's like a rich viand in your mouth.
Yes. So delicious.
Chew on them. Is the word moiety.
Moiety.
Moiety. M-O-I-E-T-Y. A part or portion, especially a lesser share. For instance, it's curious to me that in your country, a moiety of the population is imposing its thoughts and political views on the broader electorate.
That's a curious thing to have happened.
Yes. So it's called minority rule, but I digress. This has been another installment, perhaps the final of Pose Prose, but not the last time you'll see the Fogophile.
Oh,
until next time.
Man, the listicle and the Fogophile just need to do a whole episode.
Yes, exactly. They would hate it.
Talk about.
Hi, everybody.
Hello, listicle.
That'd be the episode everybody's like, what the actual?
The shark. It has been jumped.
Oh, man. That was wonderful. That was delightful. Well, listen, before we...
Glad to hear it. I'll hear it when I listen back to the show.
Yeah, exactly. And glad your fall was okay. Before we get into sort of the depths, before we, you know, dive into the themes and kind of what the show has on its mind, let's do one more bit of didactic fun, if you will. Why don't we rank, if we shall... We can do this as briskly or as in detail as we want, but let's rank from 8 to 1 the deaths of the family Usher. So if you're down,
I do want to inform you, friend.
Oh,
that. So initially I'll blame myself. I'll fall on my own shard of mirror glass here.
Oh boy.
That I perceived initially the adult children. We then expanded that to include the whole of the Usher clan.
Ah, yes.
So I'm letting you know the additions are of a slightly cuter variety in this case for me. So just know,
understood.
You know, I didn't quite have the time there. Okay. Nonetheless.
All right.
You're number 8, sir.
Oh, you want me to go first? Okay. For my number 8, and I am including in this not only the way they actually die, but the buildup, the stage setting, how everything came together. That's kind of informs how I rank these. So my number 8 is Leo. Leo is the one who is taking Mjolnir to his apartment, pounding holes in the wall everywhere, and then sees a cat, runs for it, falls off a ledge. Like, you know, it's that's basically his expiration.
So okay, well, I'll go ahead and tell you, and this will help us brisk past that one. Leo was my bottom barrel one.
Okay. Yeah.
I joked that it's cutesy. I actually don't mean it as cutesy. I just didn't put a ton of bandwidth into this, but I put the Madeline Roderick deaths at the bottom of my list.
Mm-hmm.
And that is honestly, Leo earns the bottom of the list from a setup standpoint.
Sure. Yeah.
From a thematic standpoint, none of the other deaths needed to happen. Roderick and Madeline had not done half to a third of the things they did.
Sure.
And so to me, I don't dignify them in this case, which is not to suggest you can't had a higher point on your list.
Okay.
But for me personally, it was, you know what? F those guys. That's kind of how I felt.
Yeah. Okay. I get you.
So their bottom, and then Leo for me, the technical bottom, Felatia no.
Felatia no. Oh, man. So does that mean that Leo
So we both did Leo. Go ahead.
Yeah. Does that mean, I know he was the bottom of you're there. Does that mean he now lands at 7 for you, or no, there is a different 7?
Yeah, he technically should earn the final notch on the list, but I just sort of from a moralistic standpoint wanted to throw
the siblings Usher down at the bottom.
At the bottom of the...
Because F them.
Yep.
I want to brick
them up. Yes,
yep, F them. Yep, I get it.
So then I'll do one above Leo, and then you can do your next one or two if you want.
Okay.
My one above Leo, so by your counting 8, this would be 6, is Victorine.
Though
if we're counting the whole of the setting, set dressing, choreography, blocking, what have you, hers might rank a little higher, but I just think for as elaborate as some of the deaths are, hers is as a death pretty straightforward. I didn't love it in the conversation. I still, and actually I might be in the minority here, as I've observed the conversations over time, but I actually liked the Victorine character in the show. So I kind of rooted for her a little bit. And then to see her kind of, you know, just kind of kill herself in a pretty straightforward way. That's why she's where she's at on the list.
Okay. I'll give my number 7 and 6, and then we can bounce back to you for your 5, if that's okay.
Sure.
So my number 7 is probably going to be a little controversial, because some people may wonder why it's not higher. But my number 7 is Prospero. And the biggest reason that he's so low on my list is because I did find the buildup to it with all the sexual stuff to be kind of uncomfortable, and I didn't really enjoy that. Although I do, you know, I just cited that the Mask of the Red Death story was like my 3rd favorite Poe short story. I do love how faithful of an adaptation and a direct analog that episode is, but then it gives us, you know, people soup and just so gross and you know, so nasty and everything. And I was just like, yeah. So it was more the ancillary things around it that caused it to dip so far down for me. So number 7 for me is Prospero. Number 6.
So is it a people soup or is it a people dip?
Ugh. Lord have mercy. People soup dip. Oh. No. It's people, you know, like curdled milk. Ugh.
Sure.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, that's how it feels. So, all right. So that was my number 7. My number 6, which I was the one that insisted we include the entire Usher clan. My number 6, I'm going to go with Lenore. It's a heavy death. It's a sad death. I do like that Lenore does not die violently. She dies quite quickly and peacefully, which that character, as a minimum, if it did not earn survival, deserved a quick exit. And being told the things beforehand about what good will be done because she stood up to the family, because she defied the family, because she chose to be better than the example that she had been ubiquitously set before her. So, but yeah, still in the scheme of things, in the scheme of deaths, that's my number 6 is Lenore.
Hmm.
What is your number 5?
My numbers are all screwed up at this point, but above Victorine would have been Camille, the monkey mauling. I think it's a great scene. I think given how graphic, and now the post-death aspect of Camille is pretty graphic, but given how graphic some of the actual deaths are in this, it kind of leaves, you know, it's a dramatic sort of staging, but it is not a dramatic death scene, as it were.
Yep.
So Camille is above there. You did too. I'll throw another here.
Sure.
I think I'm gonna put Frederick next. Turns out 2 Freds aren't better than 1. Is that right down here? So yeah, I mean it's a pretty clever way to make use. It's funny. I love our fog friend Matt Ruff. I think there are, as we've discussed, you and I, there are cutesy moments throughout the show that maybe shouldn't have been quite so cute, mm-hmm. you know, to make it all work. I don't find this one. I agree with a critique that it's a little bit of a forced use of Pit and Pendulum.
Yeah.
I don't agree with a criticism that thus it should have been, that it's dumb or because of that.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
If that makes sense at all.
Like, it does. Yeah.
Like in text, it organically arrives there, even if you know sort of metatextually we are forcing creatively this to happen. But nonetheless, it's a pretty grisly, gruesome death scene.
Yeah.
It's pretty rough.
So I'll give my number 5 and number 4, and number 5 for me was going to be Victorine. So Victorine for me, kind of similar to what you said, you know, she just kind of stabs herself, but I was energized tremendously. I think more so than based on the conversation we had, more so than I think anybody else on the podcast episode was. I was energized tremendously by the grisly reveal of her partner and lover, like that stage setting for the body. It's one of the series nastier moments. And so like, I was really energized by that. Also, I loved the, you know, kind of catching Roderick off guard that it does, where he's just like, oh, you know, my children have died. Somebody must have done something to them. But Victorine is his first window into, oh, no, something different is going on here. And so I loved the energy sure. around that, too. But even still, those stage settings aside, her death is really just she stabs herself in the heart, you know, which, okay. Right. But so then my number four, joining you in proximity here, was Frederick. So I think what I love about Frederick's death is Verna's speeches to him before sure. he dies. That's what I love so much about that stage setting. He's paralyzed. He can't clap back. He can't even give a response. He can't move, nothing. But she just lays into him and lets him have it in the most vicious way possible. I really love that. And I think it's a really inventive concept to have, like, yeah, let's see the demolition of this building from inside the building. That's just a really right. cool yeah. set piece thing, kind of, you know. So, so I really loved that about it. I agree. And I also wouldn't say it was dumb. I agree that the pit and the pendulum aspect, especially because, as we pointed out, in the pit and the pendulum story, the guy survives. So I do agree they're kind of shoehorning something in, but I think it's inventive. I think it's creative. And I think they made it feel like it was of a piece, even though it, you know, I mean, what are you going to do? Sure. Send him into an actual pit and have him, you know, like somebody would have to manufacture so much of that. I think the way they did it was very inventive. And I really loved the visual of it. I love those shots from inside the house, everything that Frederick is seeing. So yeah, that lands at number four for me. Let's just go one each now that we're in the top three. So you can give me your number three and then I'll give mine.
Okay. Next up my list would be Perry.
Yeah.
Prospero. And, you know, I can't stand the character, and all due respect, I'm not a huge fan currently of the actor.
Okay.
I don't even think, as we discussed in our patron segment about this episode, I don't even think for as graphic as not the death part is, but the whole setup, the Red Death comp is, I don't even like the staging of it. It's not even to yeah. me very artful. But everyone's got a big butt, Simone.
Let's What's talk about your big butt.
I mean, it's just such an insanely inventive death sequence.
Yeah.
I mean, that's maybe one of the more signature moments of the entire 8 episodes.
Sure.
You know, the flesh puddle. What are you going to do?
Oh, my God. Yeah. I forgot we called it flesh puddle.
Yeah. You know, flesh puddle, people dip.
People dip. God, have mercy. As a chips and salsa fan, do not like, oh my God, people dip. Lord have mercy. No. Okay, so my. No. Blech.
Blech. Yep.
Perry. So my number three is the twins. And the reason I put Madeline Roderick so high is because I, in your same spirit of like, hey, F those guys, they deserve to be on the bottom. Yep. I kind of love the they take each other out, so to speak. Sure. You know, he drugs her, presumably she's dead, but he, you know, cuts out her eyes, replaces them with those stones. She's got this grisly, bloody visage when she comes climbing up the stairs, but then she just puts her hands around his throat. And I feel like, you know, them taking each other out is kind of one of the most appropriate ways that they could have gone out. And then the house just falls in on top of them, which again is very, you know, a comp to the actual original story. But that's why I put that at number three for me, is because I just really felt like, oh man, that it's one of the most perfect ways that they could have gone out, because ultimately they were destroying themselves the whole time. And, so that's me. That's my number three, is Madeline and Roderick. Although I agree with your logic about My logic. I said that. Yeah. I agree with your logic of, you know, F them there at the bottom. But yeah.
That's how inside the family they would refer to a train of thought that only Roderick could have done, or like his mantra. Like, that's his self-help.
That's so Logic.
Yeah. Logic with Roderick.
Oh, you know? My gosh.
Getting what you want, no matter the cost.
All right.
Let's see.
What's your number two?
Yeah. Tamerlane.
All right.
She's just a waterbed away, brother.
She's a waterbed away. Oh my God. Wow.
For a character who, you know, you're kind of on the outs with a good bit. I just think the setup, as we discussed, when I think Vera was with us, of the, you know, the entire sort of sequence of her discovery of her fate, you know, the encroaching doom that she's on the precipice of.
Sure.
You know, just the tiptoeing through the house, the William Wilson of it all, the, you know, really, are you going to shatter another mirror? Yes,
yeah,
you are.
Yeah.
That all of that just building up to a just real, I used this word a minute ago, as radically unartful as I feel like the Red Death rave is. This is a dramatically artful way to stage a death scene for a character.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of hard to ignore the power of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So you'll learn imminently why I agree. My number two is Camille. So Camille's death was the moment the show unequivocally had me. I think I shared that when we covered that episode. Like, I was watching it. I enjoyed episode one. Episode two, I was kind of like, oh, man, I don't know. I mean, it's kind of cool what I see they're doing, but I don't know if I'm up for all of this, if this is going to be what it all is. So then when episode three came, and specifically the way that they integrated the Murders in the Rue Morgue story, Verna delivering her speech, but then leaps onto the table. It's a very galvanizing sort of set. And then the chilling, one of the coldest and I'll say scariest responses to staring into the face of death in the whole series is Camille very quickly resigning herself to what's about to happen to her and just saying, all right, F it, I got mine. And I'm just like, oh man, it's so indicative of the, you know, reprobate kind of mind that these people have. And so yeah, that's when the series, like I said, that's when they had me, and they never really lost me, but that's when the series kind of, okay, I'm in now, and I'm excited about what we're doing. So yeah, number two for me is Camille.
Do your number one, because last one will sort of segue us into something else.
Yeah, absolutely. So so that means that my number one is Tamerlane. Tamerlane is probably my least favorite of the six adult children, but her death scene, I said this when we covered the episode, so masterfully staged. It's wonderful in the construction. It's thematic. It's rich. It's scary. I mean, I'm not kidding. I can easily see myself just pulling up that scene just to watch that scene from the moment she arrives in the house till when she throws the fire poker up at the glass ceiling and all the shards of the mirrors come down upon her. It's a really fantastic visualization for a story that could have, I mean, the William Wilson story is great. But it's like when you realize, like, oh, that's the inspiration for this, and this is what you brought out of it. It's so wonderful and kind of genius. So yeah, the Tamerlane death is easily my favorite of the deaths, and I think one of the show's finest moments. Honestly, if we were to, we're not doing that kind of list, but if we were to rank, oh, what were some of your favorite moments in the show? Easily, Tamerlane would be in my top three or five, her death scene. So, yep, that's my number one.
Okay, well, you might have observed I was not at a certain point using numerals anymore as I went. Because for me, again, possibly cheeky, but sort of both playing with the form and or both honoring the ask and trying to set apart as well is Lenore. I have not currently referenced. And I even wrote down here that to the limits I was able to devote to this part, she's off the list. I wrote hers is a death, but not a dying. And that, yeah. that meant something as I was trying to weigh my overall feelings here. I'm curious from you as we sort of pivot into, deeper waters, perhaps.
Yeah.
Something that I wonder if you felt this way, or if it was kind of just me. I wrote several episodes ago, probably in at least the third, maybe fourth, forecasting my memory of the show. Part of me wishes there was more Lenore.
Yeah.
The on-screen character.
Just
the general reference. Because I think, like, that her encounter with Verna is already so fraught, and you're already so upset by it.
It's a gut punch.
As much, even for all of the logic it makes in the moment. Part of me wonders if, for a show with no virtue in sight, she is such a, the actor is great.
Yeah.
The character is lovely. It's possible I'm just asking for too much and asking for something the show just isn't interested in giving me.
Yeah.
But for a show with just zero righteousness anywhere, part of me wishes there's a little more of that peeking through.
Sure.
But I don't know. So I don't know if that's something you thought about at all. And so I'm kind of asking, do you think that's a sort of misguided want or does that make sense?
No, I don't think it's a misguided want. I do think it would probably help solidify some of the things that I feel about Verna and her intentions if there were more Lenore in there, because I get a distinct impression from Verna's conversation with Lenore and from the way that Verna tries to kind of rattle each of the kids to their senses before she takes them out, that I get this sense that she was hoping for better from them. And we can get, I don't want to drift too far from Lenore's death, and it will if I go too far down that path. So I'll go there in maybe in a bit. But I feel like Verna is asking for or expected more or expected different from the power that each of them, you know, had been bestowed. And Lenore gives that. Like, Lenore absolutely has a strong moral center. And I do wish there was more Lenore, because to be completely candid, man, I even dread kind of saying this. Like, to be completely candid, it is difficult to believe Lenore's moral center is so strong when she literally had no influences otherwise. Like, nobody gave her that. Roderick has a very poetic kind of lovely thing of like, oh, well, Annabelle Lee gave her that. Annabelle Lee, my friend, died well before Lenore was in the picture. So it is difficult to believe that Lenore is as good as she is. It's no question that she is that good. I just don't know where she got it from. And I think to your point, I wish some more of that was present in the rest of the show to substantiate that a little bit better. She works as a good contrast to the rest of the characters. But I feel like the only other place we really get that is like from Juno. And Juno wasn't an influence of Lenore, you know?
No. Well, and I'm enjoying this thread of conversation, and so many times we, especially with these meta texts, like a show like this, you know, I am not that interested in like, oh, the show I wish we'd gotten.
Sure, but yeah.
Because I think largely the show delivers what it wants.
Yes, yeah.
Delivers on what it wants to deliver on. I think maybe wrapping into what you're saying about Verna's intentions, I actually don't mind because I think to the extent it's visible, I think Flanagan is after this is his, you know, kind of, the man in black fled across the desert. Like, Verna is that.
Yeah.
And so it's this essence of evil, and knowing Flanagan's, devotion to King. King is very much a polarities writer. Mm-hmm. Like, it is there is an essence of evil. There is an essence of good. I mean, it's the hand of God in Las Vegas. It's,
yeah,
you know, the magic trick in Salem's Lot.
Yeah.
No, not Salem's Lot. Whatever we just read.
Needful Things. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Needful Things. Yep. You know, so I can totally see Flanagan's efforts at a duality here. What I kind of wish isn't just give me more Lenore. It's, I like that it wouldn't be readily comprehensible that her virtue would have survived.
I like that
because it stands as that paragon.
It
stands outside of the structure. And if you're going to add a slight new thread to the tapestry here, show me early on where Verna is anticipating the anguish it will cause Verna.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like signal that sooner to me.
Sure.
And because the way Flanagan works sometimes is he wants to hold out on you, and we're not necessarily thinking Lenore's in the line of fire until she is.
Yeah.
Whereas, no, tell me, like, give me a sense of foreboding for her that I may not feel
right
for the others.
Yeah.
You know, and that, so that, and I already think the scene, the Verna Lenore encounter is a beautifully written.
Yeah.
Just lovingly staged scene.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm dreading it more because I realize it's coming, that it might've delivered a even more powerful punch.
Yeah. I don't disagree with that at all. Yeah.
This time through, I just felt that a little bit more.
Yeah.
I could own if it's just Nathan wanting a little more heroism in his storytelling.
Sure.
I can own if that's the case. But I also, you know, think structurally it might have benefited the overall.
I'm going to reference two things real quick that are, and I'm going to try not to have too analytical a brain, but I affirm what you're saying. But of course, it is a bit of a tragedy. There's a, the Hitchcock philosophy of suspense was, if you just startle someone with a shock, then you've just startled them. That's all you've done. But you haven't generated any suspense. You've just startled them. Whereas if you show the bomb, if you show the bomb under the table and then have everybody sit down to dinner, you've created suspense because you don't know what is going to happen or what's going to, and Flanagan, for good or ill, chose to surprise us if we weren't already keyed in that Lenore was going to be taken out. He chose to surprise us with that. And I do think, to your point, it might have been more impactful if we continued to see how good Lenore was and were more clued in on the fact of, oh man, she's in the line of fire as well. Like, she's, you know, she is on this path, on this trajectory, but she does not deserve this. Unlike these others who were kind of, it's cathartic to see them get their comeuppance. She does not, she hasn't earned this, and she should have been spared this. Now, the other bit of philosophy that I find further to your point is, I've referenced before, there's a, if you've never read the book or seen the movie, this is a big spoiler, but there is a big death at the end of the novel, A Tale of Two Cities, that we, as the reader or as the encounterer of the story, know that death is coming when the movie still has a third of the way to go. We know, like, oh, this person, virtuous, self-sacrificing, this person is going to die. And the emotional roller coaster that puts you through as you see them make choice after choice that, you know, oh my God, they are choosing to make this sacrifice. But it is beautiful. It is powerful. It is, you know, and I think the one big difference there is Lenore is not choosing to give her life. It is being taken from her in a way that is, you know, her choices saved all those lives, but it does feel, you know, unjust. It's hard. It's difficult. Because she doesn't make a choice. She just gets taken out. The gift she is given for her benevolence is painlessness and swiftness, to be taken.
Well, and now that we're dwelling here, I get more energized by the idea because I feel like, I think it's in on writing, and I may just be, you know, kind of coalescing some things from memory here about what I've read of King's process, but like, write the story, revise the story, let theme get discovered and then punch up theme.
Yes,
right.
Effectively. Yes, yes.
It's like, let's get the literal story on paper, figure out what you have, and then start to kind of paint the picture
a little more
legibly.
Yeah.
Whereas I think, purely speculative here, but like the visual medium, something like TV, something like film, is a little harder to do that with. You have what you have. You've shot what you've shot. Now there's pickups, blah, 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 but it's harder to draw outside the lines, paint outside the lines once the lines are visible.
Yeah.
And because to some of what you're saying, like Lenore is very specifically spoken of as a comp to Annabelle Lee.
Yeah.
She is very much the, regardless of how she became so or what her legacy we learn ultimately is going to yield, like the manifestation of the character is the thing Roderick holds on to as what reminds him of what he lost.
Yeah.
And I just think there was an opportunity that could have been had to just make that clearer early on that she's, I don't know. You risk mythologizing the character, so I'm not necessarily asking for that. But just punching up the theme. Because the theme of Mike Flanagan's Netflix's Follow the House of Usher is absolute power will corrupt absolutely.
Yes.
Like, that is the point. It like literally and metaphorically and every adverb you want to find, the point of the show is to say pursuit of gain at all costs will destroy all things around you, regardless.
Yeah.
And so instead, what I feel when Lenore passes is a twinge of like, wow, that sucks.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what I should feel is a hammer blow of, you did this.
Yeah.
From the minute you turned on the pan, from the minute you listened to Madeline Usher 40 years ago, from the minute you walked into that bar, you did this.
Yeah.
Right. And I think the intention is what Roderick's choice causes, Lenore's passing reverses, but I don't think it's clear enough in the watching of it.
Yeah.
In a way that I think would make it stronger. It's just something I'm thinking about.
I totally agree. And I'm gonna yes and one more thing and then maybe add a comment that will bring us to possibly somewhere different. Sure. So this idea of the power of choice, primarily the only character in this whole Usher line that I see given an active moment where they could have done the right thing and chose not to is Roderick. Young Roderick had at his disposal the opportunity to do the right thing and chose not to. What is a bit distancing for me in the show, and you know what, we're pointing out a bunch of things that on paper kind of don't work for us or that we wish were different. I do love this show and
yeah, you know,
but
people tuning into this episode for the first time don't know is we've had about 8 hours of
praising all the interior stuff, and now we can kind of unpack some of these more complicated feelings. But we see young Roderick make his choice when he betrays Dupin. We see that. All the rest of them, it's really difficult. I love Verna's line to Frederick before Frederick dies. I did not write it down. I didn't know I was going to requote it, but where she says basically to him, you know, like, oh, basically you got dealt a bad hand. They did something, you know, they did horrible things to you. You just wanted daddy to love you. But then she says at the end, and it's still no effing excuse, you know, and again, that was a very, very bad paraphrase to a really powerfully written line. I wish I'd written it down. But fundamentally, none of the other kids, I don't see them get to make that. This is my challenge with the Verna wager, is I would feel more impacted by what happens if I saw each of these people be given a distinct moment where there's a chance that they could do the right thing or the wrong thing. Or, you know, if those words are too grandiose, that they could do, you know, a better choice or a worse choice. And like they have power to pivot it in one direction or another. As it stands, I see them and they're so lost and saturated in their selfishness that it feels as if it's no choice. It feels at that point as if it's just inevitable. So what we have is a march of catharsis watching terrible people get their comeuppance. Instead, what you're exploring with this concept of Lenore is, and the potential for greater tragedy is, if we had seen each of them have an opportunity to have done the right thing, actively chose not to do the right thing, or actively chose, like Roderick did with Dupin, actively chose, like, I'm going to go a different way. I'm going to go do this other thing. And then you infuse some more of Lenore in there doing the right thing repeatedly. It does drive that hammer blow home where it's just like, oh man, like we're all going to the same place. This is what it would communicate. It would be, we're all going to the same place, but how we get there matters. We are all marching towards some confrontation with death, but how we get there matters. And I feel like as it stands, the show more conveys a testament to the decay that a selfish life of hoarding wealth and power into yourself instead of using it for more common, greater benevolences is, you know, a futile and wasteful endeavor. Fine. The show makes that point, and I think it makes it really well. It would be compelling to me to dig in a little bit more on that power of choice we're kind of exploring and see, wow, Lenore chose to face her end, you know, or the march up to her end. She made so many better choices. And what that scratches up at is it puts me in a complicated place in my feelings about Verna, because Verna lays out for them like, hey, you'll get away. Here's what I wish. You're wishing there was more Lenore. I agree with you. I'm wishing Verna, when she pitched the deal to Roderick and Madeline, that there was some layering in the language that she pitched to them, say, like, you can do anything with this. You can make the world a better place. You will have the power to do great good for great many people. You'll also have the power to cause tremendous amount of destruction. I will give you the opportunity to, you know, do as you please. And I wish there was a little bit more baked into her pitch of that, that they had this choice to go one direction or another. As it stands, it feels like she's basically telling them, I'm going to give you the power to get away with everything. That's what it feels like she's pitching to them. And then when she comes to claim them, is disappointed that they chose to get away with everything. And I'm like, when I listen back to her speech, I'm like, that's, you kind of sold them on, you can do all this bad stuff and get away with it. And so then her feeling regret or sadness that they chose to do that rings hollow for me. You know what I mean? Like it's something I struggle with, because I'm like, well, you gave them the power to do this. And if it had, I'll shut up after this. If it had been positioned more as, I am going to give you the power to make a choice, and you can choose to wield that power in one way or another. And, you know, the only cost is at the end, I'm gonna, you know, claim all this. Instead, she basically is like, this is your get out of jail free card.
This is why one thing I didn't mention in last week's patron segment of That Ain't Rights, and I'm okay if we want to just, you know, like not do a formal one for this since we've done through the whole show,
sure,
and
sure,
just fold in whatever we might have otherwise. But this to me is one of the reasons the bricking of Griswold is so haunting. Is they are under no influence but their own craven desires
at that point.
Like,
yeah,
they have not encountered Verna yet.
Yeah, true.
And so, like, watching that scene this time, it was so heavy and gross and dark and just effed up. Impressive. I mean, I kind of loved it.
Sure.
I don't know. That's an impressive sequence of exclamations.
Yeah,
there.
I know. No, I get it. I mean, as a horror fan,
it's up, it's gross, it's disgusting, but I loved it.
Yeah, I mean, as a horror fan, those sequences are all very sensible. Yeah.
Well, and here's what I'll say to your note about Verna is, you know, the devil's bargain is a narrative trope as old as literature itself, mm-hmm. and and again already invoked once, but King, it's a convention King loves. And so the minute it gets revealed in the eighth episode exactly what has transpired in their transaction, the inner workings of the transaction itself wasn't as sort of integral to me in the way that you're articulating it for yourself, as much as just, oh, okay, here we are.
Yeah,
this is,
yeah,
these characters who are already on a trajectory of self-indulgence, accumulation, you know, aggregation of all things to themselves, get set. It's cocaine to a bear. It's the accelerant.
Yeah,
it is X factor thrown in to what was already starting to take shape. Now, to your point, we've heaped a ton of praise on this show. I think Flanagan loves using Carla Gugino, rightly so. I think she's found an excellent role for her in this.
Yeah.
I think it's easy to get lost in the utility of the character over its consistency, right?
Yeah.
To kind of what you're saying is like, I wish X were a little more clear, or it had been a bit more of a decision. You know, I'm not saying Flanagan's not a thoughtful writer at all. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that. I am saying the hook is the devil's bargain. Okay, yeah. Well, what does that look like here? Now, to your point, maybe you make it a bit more of a fully, you know, fully drawn picture versus just one angle of the sketch.
Sure.
But, you know, I think that scene, this sounds like I'm countermanding your note. I'm not. I love that scene. I think it's really incredibly, for a show that had been signaling an aspect of supernatural, but we're not 100% yet.
Yeah.
On the landing of that plane, when those pieces finally lock in and you see that extended scene post Griswold bricking and their after party conversation with her.
To me, I
love it. Of just here it is.
Sure.
In a way that I think earlier in the show might have stretched a little believability, like, okay. But once it's finally in place, you're like, yes, that's right. It makes total sense, you know? I do want to shout out. I've given her some praise before, and I think a find, and hopefully will continue to be used in the Flanagan traveling troupe here, is Willa Fitzgerald, who plays young Madeline.
Yes, she's wonderful.
She is exceptional.
Yeah.
And she knows how to deliver this scripting, this style of dialogue.
Absolutely.
That I don't know that everyone is as gifted at. But she's, not only is she excellent as a facsimile of a young Mary McDonnell, but, you know, she's lovely in her own right, but also fierce.
Yeah.
And you in that performance, you're like, I don't want to cross her. And
right.
Just in her line readings, I mean, she's excellent in pretty much every scene she's in.
Yeah. Oh, I absolutely agree. I want to briefly piggyback on one thing that you said, and it's going to sound bigger than I mean it to. And I don't mean us to, you know, jump into a big Titanic thing, with this, but one of the things that I struggled with in the Verna wager is exactly what you just said, is the devil's bargain. It's positioned narratively as if she's the devil, but she, Verna, the character, is so heartbroken, you know, and biting at what they've done wrong. And maybe that is, you know, one person's concept of the devil, but I'm like, I'll say this. I'm not disagreeing. It's a devil's bargain scenario. No devil in a typical devil's bargain scenario would have ever shown Lenore that much compassion, would have ever shown her that much generosity in what she shared with her about, like, hey, this is what's going to happen to you. So it conflicts it a little bit for me, because then when you wind it back, what you begin to see when she, it's a powerful image. A very powerful image. I would not trade the image for anything. But when Roderick is looking out the window and all the bodies are falling,
right,
and she says, this is your, I can't remember if she says legacy or whatever. It's like this is your
right, right.
this is who you are. This is what you have. This is your empire. Like all the bodies falling.
Your empire of dirt.
Ooh. And
you like that?
I do. I love me some cash. And I know it was a cover, but still. So what I thought in that moment watching this episode is, forgive the harshness of this, but when I watched that, I could not beat back the thought of, Verna, that's as much your legacy as his. You're the one positioned him to do this. You're the one gave him the keys to do this. So it's a dissonance that I struggle with applauding her. I'll tell you whose I applaud. I applaud Dupin. I love, 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 love Dupin's last word on this, where he said, I'm the richest man in the world. Like, I love that so much, because that felt like such a thematic, rich bow being tied on, like, okay, because Dupin has taken a journey. He devoted so much of his life to taking down these guys that he did make some poor choices in his relationship with his husband, in his relationship with his kids. But he is not going to do that anymore. He is walking away different, you know, and he's learning now. And so him realizing, like, oh yes, okay, I am the richest man in the world. I thought that was just so beautiful. I thought it was really powerful. And I thought it was one of the show's more cogent moments of, like, this is what you're trying to say. You're trying to say that the, you know, vapid acquisition of wealth and just trying to pile on things for yourself you said it, I think, in one of our earlier patron segments, that it's literally the, what does it profit you if you gain the whole world and lose your soul? And to a degree, this is what I'm trying to not get too cosmic here. You know, I've heard similar complaints leveled at atrocities that happen and they get associated with God. I'm not about to have this big theological conversation. I think it's too big for this moment. I think it's too big for this series, but people level the same thing as, like, well, how can God, it's a passive kind of question, but they'll point to and they'll say, like, well, how could God allow this or permit this or empower this? And one of my theological constructs is, like, well, we have what I keep scratching at and said earlier, like, this power of choice before us that we can tilt it this way or that way. And there's a constant sort of influence that we can choose to actively deny that's trying to push us into something more neighborly, more communal, more benevolent and self-sacrificing, and trying to push us that way, that influence. And the reason the Verna thing hiccups for me is she does not present them with that choice. Instead, she's like, you want to go get away with a bunch of stuff? Yeah, you can go get away with a bunch of stuff. And it feels like to me, and I'll end it at this, because I'm not even really totally making a big case. It feels to me as if that is how many, many people see the I think, poorly constructed theology of, like, well, God gives people all these opportunities to do these terrible things and doesn't stop it and doesn't intervene. And it feels like Verna is I'll say it this way. It feels like Verna is a representation of a godlike figure for somebody who doesn't believe in God. And that's what somewhat bothers me about her presence in this show.
Well, and this is what I was trying to articulate with Flanagan. It's kind of like he can't help but point to some ideological things that make you bump on the scripting moment in a otherwise pretty lovely scene. He also, to his credit, he also can't help but service the performers he loves. And there's a version of this show that is just the Raven haunting Roderick and encircling the present day narrative.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
That only features Carla Gugino in the primary past tense action in the bar.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because what you've basically identified is the effort to use this character beyond the initial function of the quote unquote devil's bargain. And I know you know this, but I was using that in a more literary, conventional sense. Because I agree with you, it's not meant to be a literal Mephistopheles here.
Right.
But when you choose to use her later, you have to reconcile it somehow, and they don't.
Yeah.
And I don't disagree with you on that.
Sure.
And which is, I think I said this on our episode 8 patron segment, but, like, I kind of reconciled myself to it. Once on this watch through, it started to become more legible, that that thing. I was like, well, okay, I mean, is what it is. It gives some good scripting moments for Carla Gugino, some interesting character beats for the adult kids, but and setups. But I also think there's an interesting version of the show that is characters are already in motion, i.e. Young Mads and Madeline and Usher. Accelerant speeds it up, but then is never part of the narrative again. And the deaths she forecasted are occurring because the deaths are occurring. Not because she's interceding later on.
Does that
make sense?
It does. Yeah, it does. And arguing with myself, it can't be, there's a very real case to be made that she positioned all of this maybe in the hopes they would do better, but then in the end, you can't ignore Lenore's legacy and her mother, Morella, recovering, like everything that Verna shares with her about, you know, all the good that will be done for that, all the lives that will be saved from that. Juno dissolves the Fortunato Company, and then all the endless amounts of lives that are helped by, you know, those nonprofits for abuse victims and everything like that. And so there's a very real case to be made that it's like, well, if you doubt Verna's compassion, those end results were her end game. And again, that's why I say this feels like Verna is a version of a godlike figure for somebody who can't quite wrap their hands or their head around God. Because it's this idea of a version of benevolence, but also an empowerment of some wickedness, and those kinds of things clash and collide in ways that are not ethically or even narratively consistent all the time. And honestly, I know listeners who have only listened to this, wait for the complete conversation and hear us gush for 8 hours about the, it wasn't actual 8 hours, but like gush for 8 episodes about this show. I actually do think there's a tremendous power to this show's capacity to indict and hold a mirror up on, like, hey, this is the profitability. When you decide you're going to, you decide from the beginning who cares about the next generation. That's the yep. one choice. Again, yes. I'm arguing with myself. That's the one choice she gives to them. Like, you can choose to abandon the next generation, and the next generation will foot the bill. And this is the profitability. This is the result. And there is a powerful moral and ethical and narrative exploration being had here about the dangers and risks of the, well, I care about me and I care about my comfort and my power and my empire, and I don't care or give thought to what my grandchildren and my grandchildren's grandchildren are going to inherit from what I'm laying out. And I do think that the show, when it points towards that, does so powerfully, effectively, hauntingly, and in many cases, brilliantly. Despite the critiques I've hurled at the Verna character, I do think that element of the show lands exceptionally well.
Yeah, I think if I had any final thoughts, it's the Dupin Roderick dichotomy is such a fascinating one to me, and I think what's scary about the show, it is laced with lines like in episode one, no one gets away with anything, not really.
Mm.
In episode two, was it ever going to be enough? In episode three, there are always consequences.
Yeah.
So there is this march of comprehension of the moral stakes at work.
Right.
And yet, like, this is a, you know, we use the metaphor of the hammer blow a minute ago. Like, this is kind of the hammer blow for me, is watching this narrative play out and ignoring the cutesy attempts at connectivity to the real world, because the story itself is doing what it's supposed to do.
Right.
The comprehension that we can empirically know no one really gets away with anything, and at the same time absolutely pursue our own gain at
right
to say at all cost is an understatement.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, read the staggering, you know, let's reinvent scripture for a second. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul? In 2024, you know, unfettered capitalistic economic America developed world, what good is it for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit hundreds of thousands of souls?
Right.
As Dupin says, was it ever going to be enough?
Right. Like, yeah.
Our mutual friend Ian sometimes overuses this phrase, but often uses the phrase the death drive. Our unwillingness to pull out of the skid.
Right. Yeah.
Regardless of the carnage and chaos we're wreaking in our wake.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, and from that standpoint, it's a pretty heavy show that even with Dupin's lovely ending, you're still like, yeah, but.
right. But I do think that's the show pulls out of the skid in the last 5 minutes, where it shows, you know, it had revealed what Lenore's legacy was earlier in the episode. But when it reveals what happens with Juno, that the Fortunato company is completely dissolved, when it reveals all of that, when it reveals that, like, you know, even Pym, who was a monster in his own right, you know, just doesn't utter a word in his defense. And then we see, you know, Dupin kind of come to the resolution of all that he'd learned from his journey. I think when Verna lays out all of the sort of the token trinkets of each individual's death, like, this is the thing that kind of this was your undoing. I get this strong sensibility of how much we trade for something so small, to use the show's language. Annabelle Lee said it to Madeline, "You are so small." Madeline, being cheeky, wrote it on a brick when she was bricking up Griswold, "You are so small." We trade such, I heard C.S. Lewis, man, I am going to butcher this quote, but I read in a C.S. Lewis book one time where we trade the feast at the Lord's table for mud pies. And it's this notion,
I've heard that one.
Yeah, that it's this notion that basically, like, we have so much goodness before us, and because of some self-preservation or because of some self, indulgence, we trade it for, you know, just this very, very fleeting, futile little mess. And so anyway, I think we could probably go on indefinitely, and I don't really feel that that's totally necessary. I find this show as, you know, maybe a segue to possibly get us to Fog Meter. I find this show to be very, very compelling. Among Flanagan's best, I think it's, you know, among some of his strongest work. I wouldn't cite it as like my favorite work of his, but I think it's among his strongest work. And I think it's chock full of some really powerful, and interesting ideas. I wish some of the other things were a little bit more morally and ethically propped up, because I believe he is making some really cogent and potent ethical and moral statements. But I feel like there was just some inconsistencies I had to get off my chest. And I feel like maybe I've chosen the the summation episode to unfurl all of those instead of just but at the same token, these are the things that the show makes me think about, and I feel like that is to the show's credit, even where narratively I would have made some different choices. Do you have anything else you want to throw in before we go to Fog Meter?
I think I've pointed to most. I found myself this go round a stronger appreciator of the show, which isn't a rewatch, yielded greater affection. That is a thing, but also reading the texts alongside it. I did want to shout out here at the final buzzer, Bruce Greenwood. He just home run after home run.
Wonderful.
In almost every scene, every episode, like he just, he understood the assignment. He delivers kind of beyond what even the text might require of him. I just almost every scene he's in is a good one.
I love that dude. We mentioned it in the earlier segments that this was originally Frank Langella in the casting. Some impropriety got him fired from the show. Bruce Greenwood came in. The cast has given interviews where they said that once Greenwood arrived, it was like a big breath of fresh air and everybody breathed a deep sigh of relief. I love the dude. I love his performance. I love that you called back to him right here in this moment because he is perfect. He is so wonderful in every single scene of this show. And what a godsend that he wound up, as circumstances would have it, anchoring this show in an incredible performance. So love it so much. Okay. Well, if you are content, we can go to the fog meter. The fog meter is our very specific metric of fear and God, where we rate these, the media, films, or in this case, a series, on their scares, how disturbing, gross, gnarly, upsetting, frightening a thing is, and its substance, or what it has on its mind and how effectively it conveys that. So we do that by fear and God. Nathan, I am going to invite you to give me both numbers. What is your fear and your God measurement for the fall of the House of Usher?
I think with this series, Flanagan really creates a showcase for his capacity as a horror storyteller. Not just in grisly set pieces, but in if there's anything that doesn't fit what I'm saying is overall, I'm not sure the dread quotient is super high for the show, but you know, the jump scares we've referenced more than once that almost every episode gives like a legitimate with minimally diminishing returns because of the way they're utilized. So I think that coupled with what is legible of its moral argument makes it pretty scary. So I think I'm gonna go 8.5 on fear.
All right.
For God, I'm gonna pull back a little bit just because to our point, I think the exercise of synthesizing Poe is a worthwhile one, and he basically delivers admirably there. I think an effort is made to turn it into a morality tale. I just think that the finer, the edges are a little too sanded down to kind of make it make perfect sense from that standpoint.
Yeah.
But I applaud kind of the effort there. So I'm going to give it a 7 because okay. I think he's after something. He misses, but not by like a long shot.
Yeah. Man, it's so interesting because here's where I'm going to go with these same measurements. For fear, I'm actually going to land at a 7 myself. I feel like the metatextual stuff is pretty strong, pretty harrowing. I feel like, to your point, like we really only get probably one big good jump scare per episode, but boy, when they're there, they'll get you. But I think overall 7 feels right for me in terms of its nightmarish quality, its gruesomeness quality. For the God meter, it's really a tough call for me this time around, but I'm going to land on an 8 for myself. And part of that is bolstered up from what I would otherwise have given it because I think the adaptation and synthesis that you described of Poe is so strong. If I were rating this just on how creative, inventive, and effective of an adaptation of a work is it, it would be like 10 plus. I think his processing here of Poe's texts is masterful, and I'm just unspeakably impressed at his ability to bring those into a modern context. And honestly, the only reason that isn't a more unbridled affection are a lot of what I've spent the last hour and a half talking about some of the confusion in the ethical constructs of the character of Verna that I think the show does stumble a little bit, especially on a rewatch. It stands out more to me. But otherwise, I still think it's very, very strong. So yeah, that's why I landed in general, with an 8 on that. And that means that we give The Fall of the House of Usher an 8 on the fog meter, which is a solid substantive showing. I think that's a good representation for it. So after 8 patron segments and after, you know, hour and a half here talking, where are you at on this series?
I'm a fan. I don't know that it's one I'll revisit frequently, but I'm glad to have revisited it. And I made this offhanded reference in a patron segment that I wish was less offhanded and more of a reality. Like, you know, give me the Dupin Usher supercut. Like, that would be a cool, you know, 3-hour hang or whatever it would translate to. Like, something I didn't mention but thought about after my fear assessment is just the gothic quality of the production design itself. Like, it
kind of
bolsters some of that energy, some of that curl up with a good book by the fire and get scared by a ghost story type of energy. I think it is one I'll point to as like, I dig it. Flanagan's still my man. I don't know if or when Midnight Mass will be topped for me, but this one, I think this go round yielded more positive dividends, even if some of its weaknesses got more legible also.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair assessment. For me, I'm largely in the same place. I think what I loved about it stood out more to me. What I stumble over was more prominent this go round. I think this is easily top 3 of Flanagan's series. I think probably for me top 5 of all of his works. I really think it's effective. He rekindled my affection for Edgar Allan Poe. You know, I've loved rereading these short stories. I'm probably, when all this is done, going to go back and read some that were just, you know, just because I've enjoyed connecting with those. I'm like, I may check out a few others that I haven't revisited in some time. And so I just really love that. I do think I'll probably revisit this series over time, or at least parts of it, if not the whole thing. Because I think it is really creative and inventive, and I enjoy so much of its interior, despite some of the things that I would point to and be like, well, that one kind of was wonky for me. I'm really, really a big fan of this. Even if it doesn't quite topple the overwhelming affection I have for shows like Hill House and Midnight Mass. But it's easily just right there. That's The Fall of the House of Usher. It fell.
We did it.
Yeah, we did it. We tired.
Look at us.
Yeah, we tired. We made it though. So next week, everybody, we will be doing one final official look back at the films of 2023. That series after next week is largely concluded, and we will move on to other little mini series in this year of the Fear of God podcast. But next week, we're going to have a little epilogue, a little coda, a film that kind of flew, it kind of created a big wave when it was initially released and then kind of flew under the radar after that. But Nathan and I have both seen it, and I think we're both really excited to talk about it. Next week, we are going to be talking about the largely dialogue-free alien invasion film called No One Will Save You, starring Caitlin Dever. I'm very, very excited to talk about that. So, as we say on every episode, the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom, but not the end of the conversation. And in that spirit, we encourage you to fear nothing else and be on your way rejoicing. We will see you all next week. The fear of God is the beginning of wisdom, but not the end of the conversation. And you can continue the conversation in a variety of ways. Start by visiting thefearofgodpodcast.com for links to our social media, essays, an episode archive, merchandise, and more. If you love what we do, please consider becoming a patron by visiting patreon.com/thefearofgodpodcast. There, you'll unlock exclusive bonus episodes, extended standard episodes, online event access, and so much more. We want to issue a special thanks to Jacob Hunt of TracerMatula.com for our artwork. Also to our assortment of talented musicians, including Andrew Nelson, the Island Family, and Jackson Harper for our varied show tunes. And also to Lee Wright, who helped me, Reed Lackey, write our theme music. Special thanks also to Tyler Smith at MoreThanOneLesson.com. Lastly, be sure to subscribe to us on your podcast platform of choice. And if you listen to us through Apple Podcasts, we would greatly appreciate a rating and a review. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next week.
Hi, everybody.